I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome once again to the Mark Steiner Show here on WEAA. Phone number is 410-319-8888. Or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. There's been a lot going on in the news today. We've seen all that. The Senate passed the bill to bail out Wall Street. The House is going to debate on it. Nobody knows exactly what's going to happen in the House. We'll be following that very closely. And, of course, tonight is the debate between the two candidates of vice president of the major parties. We're all looking forward to that. And Monday, we'll be talking about that and more here on the Mark Steiner Show. Today, we're going to talk about two other things. One thing that is up in front in the news here in Maryland, and the other that is in the news in alternative press, but has not been seen much in the major press. And we think we ought to know about it. And what we're going to talk about in just a little bit was revealed by Joshua Kors, who is an investigative reporter for The Nation magazine, about veterans returning home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and the difficulties they have of getting benefits. And I think you all would be shocked, unless you're a veteran yourself or family of a veteran, to realize that veterans, even when they're wounded by shrapnel, with shrapnel in their bodies, have to prove to the Veterans Administration that they deserve disability. We'll talk about that in just a little while with our guests who are coming up. But right now we're going to talk with David Rocha. He is the staff attorney for the ACLU. He is the one who filed suit on behalf of anti-death penalty groups and anti-war groups who were spied upon by the state police. His reports forced an investigation by the state led by Steve Sachs, former attorney general. The report was released today, and we could not get through to Steve Sachs, though I'm sure he'll join us one day soon when we'll come back to this issue. But David Rocha from the ACLU is with us now. David, welcome. Good to have you with us. We have David there. Hide him up. Hi, David.
Mark, can you hear me?
Yes.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you with us. And so the report came out today that said that the state police did in fact spy on citizens of the state of Maryland, but that there was no ill intent, that no one should be prosecuted, that it was didn't appear not to go up the line, and that we can put guidelines in place to ensure this does not happen again. But somehow I have a sense you're not satisfied with that.
I'm not sure that I would necessarily characterize the report in the same way that you did. I think the report that was released was scathing in its criticisms. And I think it very clearly said that it did go up the line, up through and specifically including Colonel Tim Hutchins, who was the head of the Maryland State Police at the time, who former Attorney General Sachs specifically found was aware of the covert surveillance going on, despite the fact that Mr. Hutchins denied it when the story first broke back in July. And what Mr. Sachs found, and I think accurately, was what he called a culture of obliviousness in the Maryland State Police, a police force that had completely lost its moorings and had complete disregard for the legal limits on their behavior and the implications of what they were doing. And the report itself is among the most shocking documents I have ever read, and I think is brutally honest in its conclusions and findings. And, you know, whether or not people should be criminally prosecuted for this is not something that I have spent much time thinking about. I think that is sort of to misplace the focus.
Well, what should be the focus then?
Well, the focus is on why it happened and what's going to be done to make sure it never happens again. There is one aspect of the report where I respectfully disagree with Mr. Sachs, and that is as to what needs to be done to prevent this from happening again. And I think the lessons of history teach us quite clearly that if you want to prevent this from happening, you need to put legislation in place that specifically prohibits it. Because this is not the first time there has been a scandal like this, either in Maryland and certainly not in the country as a whole. And each time there is a scandal like this, where the police overreach and do this kind of improper surveillance of political protest activity, when it finally gets disclosed, the police, the whatever police agency we're talking about, comes with its tail between its legs and says, yes, yes, it was wrong. We realize that now. It never should have happened. And we swear, we promise, we'll never do it again. And if you wait a couple years, somewhere, someplace, another police agency is doing the same thing all over again. And there's a, you know, an important saying or quip, I don't know the author, but the saying is, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And I think that applies with tremendous force here.
But the question is, here we've seen that the Maryland State Police, who spied on citizens who were part of an anti-war group, others who were part of a group that opposed the death penalty, specifically against one man who was about to be put to death, mm-hmm. were spied upon, undercover agents were assigned, money was spent, and I wonder when we go back to that, we've seen also from the article that Governor Ehrlich and others' administration would not be questioned,
mm-hmm.
refused to be questioned.
That was very interesting.
So we don't know how high up the chain this went. I mean, even though that may not be the most important question, whether people should be prosecuted or not, I mean, there does seem to be some unanswered questions here about whose policy was this and why.
Right. I don't mean to suggest that there aren't unanswered questions. I think, you know, Mr. Sachs's mandate, I think, from the governor was actually, in some sense, narrow. He was asked to give a definitive account of what happened with respect to the spying that was disclosed in the documents that we obtained through our Public Information Act lawsuit. And I think he has likely done that. But it is also clear from Mr. Sachs' report that what we already know is only a part of what there is to know and only a part of what we need to know. So Mr. Sachs' report makes quite clear that the spying that took place was a part of a much broader effort by the Maryland State Police to gather intelligence about peaceful, lawful political protest groups generally. And Mr. Sachs makes clear that he did not have the time and was not asked to investigate that. And I think it is incumbent on the State Police to fully disclose the full scope of that activity.
So now, does that mean you will file more lawsuits to have more disclosed?
If it doesn't happen voluntarily, then we will use every legal tool at our disposal to do that. And as I think you know, on Tuesday, just before this report was released, we filed new Public Information Act requests on behalf of 32 different political activist organizations in Maryland and more than 250 individuals associated with those groups, seeking to get precisely that information.
Now, you also seem to recommend that it's not enough for the state police to say and the governor to say we'll have guidelines that will protect us from this. We will not allow these things to take place unless there's good reason, there's a real threat to security for investigations to take place. But your argument is that that's not enough, that we have to have actually laws be debated in Annapolis.
That's exactly right. I think the principles that Mr. Sachs has announced in the report as to the rules that should guide the police behavior are sound principles, and they're things that we have talked about from day one. But I think it is critical that they be embodied in law and not simply in internal police policies and procedures. Internal police policies and procedures are written behind closed doors. They can be changed at a whim, and they can be violated with impunity. And when we're talking about something as critical as this that goes to the very heart of what it means to live in a free and democratic society, I think the people, especially in light of what happened, especially in light of the systemic culture of obliviousness documented in this report, especially in light of the fact that the state police to this day, as documented in this report, many of them think that they did absolutely nothing wrong, I think it is critical that the people themselves have a say in what the rules are, that the rules be crystal clear and laid out for all to see, and that they be binding statewide among all police departments. And you can do that only through legislation.
Well, Dave Rocha, we're going to continue talking about this as this unfolds. We appreciate you always being available to us to have conversations, and we'll continue taking a look at this in our, as we develop our own civil liberties watch here on the Mark Steiner Show. We thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark, and thank you for covering it.
David Rocha is a staff attorney for ACLU, and we will be covering this some more. We have put a call in to Steve Sachs in the governor's office to get further comment. And when we return, we are going to take a look at the situation facing veterans in this country, shocking situations where veterans who have been injured in battle have to come back and prove their disability before they get disability. Something's wrong here. We're going to find out what. We'll be right back. I'm Mark Steiner. We're going to take a look at a continuing story that Joshua Kors has been investigating for some time. He's been a guest on our show before. He's an investigative reporter who's been doing a lot of work in The Nation magazine, among others. He's a winner of the National Magazine Award and the George Polk Awards, among many others, for his work in uncovering the veterans' benefit scandals in the last year. His latest work is really discovering something pretty outrageous when it comes to our veterans. We're going to explore that this hour. We're also joined by Paul Sullivan, who's executive director of an organization called Veterans for Common Sense, and Sergeant Juan Jimenez, who is a veteran who served in Iraq and is part of a lawsuit against the Department of Veterans Affairs. And Sergeant Jimenez and Paul Sullivan and Josh Kors, welcome. Good to have you all with us.
Good to be with you, Mark.
And Sergeant, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate you taking the time. I know we're going through a lot. It means a lot to us that you're willing to appear today. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Joshua, let's take a step backwards here and talk a bit about this piece that first came out in The Nation on September the 15th. And on the heels of the work you did before, I mean, there's this unfolding morass that is the Veterans Department, the Veteran Affairs Department. It's a pretty sad case, but this is revolving on a case that was built around Sergeant Juan Jimenez. Just give us some of the background.
Sure. Well, hopefully in a moment Juan can tell a little bit more of his story.
Oh, absolutely. So we're going to go next.
Struck by a roadside bomb while serving in Iraq, won 2 Purple Hearts for his injuries, and after that blow to his head, the traumatic brain injury, developed seizures, headaches, a host of other war-related illnesses. He actually had a seizure while he was at a VA facility upon his return, and his VA doctor gave him epilepsy medication. But when it came time to give him disability benefits, the VA rater, who decides just what your disability rating is, how large your disability check will be, decided that he wasn't actually eligible for any kind of check because they couldn't prove that he had seizures.
Let me turn to the sergeant now, because it's a good place to kind of bring you in, Sergeant Jimenez. And again, welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you with us. And thank you so much for your service to our country. Let me start with that.
Thank you.
Talk a bit about your sojourn. And you went to Iraq. And if I understand that your mission in Iraq, you were in charge of moving around high officials around Baghdad?
Yes.
Talk a bit about your work. What happened to you in Iraq?
Okay, I was escorting top officials around Baghdad and Al-Hilla area. Back in April of 2004, that's when I struck my first IED, and I received shrapnel to the right arm, shoulder, and some small pieces to the face. And soon after that, I started experiencing headaches. I'm not aware that I had any seizures at that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did have some hearing loss. And then in October, I struck another IED and was hit in the face again. So once I returned home, that's when I put in a claim at the VA.
Now, when you got home, did you... have any understanding of what the rules were in the Veterans Administration and what you had to do before you walked through those doors?
Well, I knew that we had to bring our LODs, which is on the line of duty documentation, showing that we actually did see a doctor while in country. So I had both of my LODs showing that I was injured, and I went to the VA, and that's when I had to fill out a stack of paperwork. And once I did that, I put in for the traumatic brain injury because I was having headaches and seizure disorder. Well, the VA, in return, said that my seizure disorder was and my memory loss was due to drinking caffeine. So I put in an appeal, and then, again, that came back with a negative result stating that it was due to a car accident I had 21 years ago. And just recently, I went back again to get reevaluated, and now they're blaming it on a stop smoking medication called bupropion, which is also used for PTSD. They're stating that now that's the cause. But I was having the seizures before I even started that medication.
I'm going to be trying now to introduce to our listeners Paul Sullivan, who is Executive Director of Veterans for Common Sense. Paul, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Now, I want to get to the heart of this and why you filed a lawsuit on behalf of Sergeant Jimenez and others and how that transpired. And first of all, explain to us what your group is, Veterans for Common Sense.
Well, Veterans for Common Sense is based in Washington, D.C., and we're a 501c3 nonprofit charity. We work mainly on veterans issues. We have offices in Washington, D.C., and we have more than 13,000 members, including Sergeant Juan Jimenez, who's on your show today.
I hear the dog. And so who tell us about the lawsuit that you filed.
Well, what we found is that the Department of Veterans Affairs was reported in many news stories turning away veterans who were suicidal. And that's absolutely outrageous. You know, if someone shows up in an emergency room after a car crash, we expect the doctors to provide prompt care. Well, here were veterans going on multiple tours saying that they were suicidal and asking for mental health care, only to be turned away by VA. And the reason for that is not that the VA doctors don't care. I want to be very clear. The doctors at VA really want to try to do the best.
Right.
What happened is that there was no plan by the current administration to take care of the 1.7 million service members we've sent over the two war zones. And here's what's happened. Right now, the Department of Veterans Affairs is treating 350,000. That's right, 350,000 Iraq and Afghanistan war veteran patients. That's why there's a long waiting line. That's why veterans are being turned away. And more than 300,000 disability claims. There was no plan to take care of all this. And that's why folks like Sergeant Jimenez are having to wait and get improperly denied, is because the VA employees are simply buried in paperwork.
Joshua Kors, I want to bring you back in this conversation, and I hear what Paul Sullivan is saying. I remember the conversations we had before when you were on my previous program, where we were talking about what veterans were going through then, trying to get care. And being denied and being said that you can't get care because you had a previously existing condition, so you don't qualify for these benefits.
That's right. And you talked a moment about the heart of the issue.
Right.
I think the heart of the issue here is something that the American people don't really even know about, and that's that wounded soldiers coming back from Iraq have to prove that their wounds came from Iraq before they can get benefits. In Jimenez's case, you'd think it would be a very simple proof. This is a soldier who still has shrapnel embedded in his skin, and yet here he is 3 years down the line, and he's still fighting the VA for his disability benefits.
That's the numbers of people this is happening to. I mean, one of the things, I know maybe none of you can speak to this, we can talk about it a bit later, Joshua, because you and I talked about this in the air last time with some other guests who were on. Is the idea that the Veterans Affairs Administration is overwhelmed, and we're going to walk through some of the things that you've learned in your report, is that many people are starting to argue that maybe this is because we can't afford to take care of our veterans, And the exponential amount of money that does it take care of veterans, the more you can slough off, the less money you have to spend.
Well, there certainly are financial components to this. With the fraudulent diagnosing of pre-existing conditions, we talked before about how that's saving the military $12.5 billion in disability and medical care. I think this is really a different animal. This is a system that's set up to put the burden of proof on the soldier. In many cases where they don't have the documentation to show wounds during war, they have to bring in witnesses, so-called buddy statements, to show that they were there during the rocket attack or roadside bomb blast. Well, you know, what if the other soldiers there at the scene died during the attack? Now they have no witnesses. It's a very complicated system that I think a lot of soldiers, like Sergeant Jimenez, didn't really even realize they'd have to go through. They thought that, you know, after being struck in the face and getting the Purple Hearts, it would simply be assumed that the injuries that followed would be the result of war. The VA just didn't feel that way. And speaking to many of the top VA officials about why this system's set up, it's very interesting, their justification. Money is certainly a factor. VA spokeswoman Carrie Childress talked about that to eliminate this proof system would open the door to fraudulent claims of all types. She phrased it to me quite interestingly. She said that a lot of these soldiers, they are either going to jail or going to the military. And people like that, you simply can't trust to accurately report their wounds. The VA has also made an argument that it would be an affront to honestly wounded soldiers if they opened the door to all soldiers and some fraud got in.
Now, let me just turn to our other guests and we introduce you all. Joshua Kors, you just heard, wrote the article, How the VA Abandons Our Vets, in The Nation magazine. He's an award-winning investigative reporter. We're joined by Sergeant Juan Jimenez, who is a veteran who served in Iraq, who's the focus of the story and of the lawsuit against the Department of Veterans Affairs to get his disability. And Paul Sullivan is Executive Director of Veterans for Common Sense, who filed that lawsuit along with others. Number here is 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. Many of you listening to this program are veterans, have families who have served. We'd like to hear your thoughts on what you're hearing now on the outrageous cases we're talking about. We did ask the Veterans Affairs Department to join us. They declined. They never responded to us. And you can write to us also here at steinershow@gmail.com. Call us at 410-319-8888. Before I turn it back to Paul Sullivan, Sergeant, I wanted to just, how many other men and women that you served with have you talked to or facing these similar situation?
Right now I keep in contact with three that are going through similar experiences. One of them lives in Oklahoma. He actually is receiving benefits for TBI, but not for PTSD, if you can believe that.
And what's TBI?
That's traumatic brain injury.
Right.
So,
but not post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right. So he's fighting to receive those benefits.
Paul Sullivan, I mean, as someone who's fighting for veterans all the time with your organization, I mean, I know how bad veterans administrations can be, they always have been a tough place to get through. But this sounds almost absurd. It sounds as if we're living in kind of an Alice in Wonderland place.
You know, you're absolutely right, Mark, and it's actually a little bit more pernicious, a little more obnoxious than Joshua Kors said. 2 points you might want to know. First, I am a Gulf War veteran. I was a scout in the first invasion of Iraq in 91.
Mm-hmm.
And second, I used to work at the Department of Veterans Affairs, where I monitored Gulf War veterans, Iraq War veterans, and Afghanistan War veterans. And I'm going to tell you something that I testified about in front of Congress that shocked Congress. When I was briefing some political appointees at VA in early 2005 about the flood, the tidal wave of disability claims from Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, one of the political appointees responded when I was done by saying that if these Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans simply believed in God and country, they wouldn't come home with post-traumatic stress disorder.
No, that didn't really happen.
Yes, it really happened. I testified under oath in front of Congress about it, and the VA officials have never disputed my account because, of course, there was a room full of witnesses. I really want folks to know that VA is in really serious trouble, mainly because the top leadership under the current administration doesn't get it. The policies, the 23-page claim form, is a nightmare. Asking someone with a mental health condition or TBI, a brain injury, to fill it out is unfair and unreasonable. And then on top of that, VA just hasn't had enough money for several years, so the staff has been overworked and burnt out. And here's what's needed. The VA doctors, most of whom that work there, and I've met a lot of them all over the country, they really do care. We want to encourage our veterans with mental health conditions to seek out help from VA and know that it's okay to come back from a war and have some sleepless nights and worry about it and want to go get help. But here's the flip side of the coin, Mark. When a veteran shows up for care or disability benefits, the VA better help them right away. And that's the square deal our veterans are fighting for. That's what our lawsuit was about, because if there are hundreds of thousands of veterans waiting, just like there are right now, then the current system creates a system of mass injustice where everybody is suffering, and that's just wrong.
Now, what I understand, let's talk about why this is. That when veterans come back from Afghanistan or Iraq or the Gulf, and they are claiming disability, there's a 26-page form they have to fill out that some people think is very complex, but you're not allowed to get a lawyer to help you fill it out. Am I right about that, Sergeant?
That's right. Absolutely right, Mark. And I spoke with Dr. James Terry, the head of the VA's Board of Appeals, and he was really insensitive about this. You can imagine a lot of veterans leaders, like Paul Sullivan and others, are concerned that the most wounded soldiers, the ones with traumatic brain injury, men who haven't slept in several months because of PTSD, would be scared off by that application process and the fact that due to American law, they are essentially forced to go it alone. He said that, I have a PhD, but even if I only had a third grade education,
That's right.
I think I could fill out the form. That's the kind of insensitivity that I think has angered a lot of people in the veterans community. Certainly, I can tell you, as someone with an Ivy League education, I looked through the legal jargon of this 26-page form and found it hard to navigate myself the extraneous material, legal jargon, medical mumbo-jumbo. There was financial information about resources and about your wife and your wife's former husband and the location of your wife's former husband's place of marriage. It just went on and on with items you'd think has absolutely nothing to do with a soldier seeking immediate medical care.
I suppose, Sergeant Jimenez, the forms you filled out in order to join the military were much simpler.
Yes.
So, I wonder again, I mean, here, we have an all-volunteer army. You chose to go into the military. You chose to be part of a group to defend this country when called upon. And you come back to face this.
Right.
I just wonder what, I mean, I'm just curious, just on a personal level, kind of an emotional level for yourself, what's that like for you? I mean, to have to have gone through all what you've gone through to come back with this serious traumatic injuries and then be faced with having to fight to get your benefits?
You know, for me personally, if I had to do it again, I would do it again. I'm a soldier first. I lifted my right hand for a reason, and, you know, I still believe in God and country. But my main issue with this is, if I raise my hand without any hesitation, why should you hesitate to help the wounded soldier? And like Paul stated, The doctors, for the most part, you know, they're doing their job. Every VA I have been to, the doctors state that I do have these disabilities. But once the raters get it, you know, it's a different story.
And you're not allowed to even talk to the rater, the person who rates your disability. You can't personally talk to them.
Right.
That's Sergeant Juan Jimenez, who's one of our guests. And Juan Jimenez is a veteran who served in Iraq. He was hit twice by an IED, the second time severely injured, the first time he was severely injured. And joining us also is Joshua Kors, who took the sergeant's story and other stories to expose of the VA who's not taking care of veterans. Was coming back, an article called How the VA Abandons Our Vets. There was a Nation magazine. Paul Sullivan, executive director of Veterans for Common Sense, brought a lawsuit on behalf of the sergeant and others to fight for this, fight veterans to get their benefits. We contacted the Department of Veterans Affairs, offered them an opportunity to join this program or send a statement, which they declined to do. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Whether it's just to offer your thoughts, maybe you've been through the Veterans Department yourself, have worked in the Veterans Department, or just offer your own ideas and opinions about what you're hearing. 410-319-8888. Paul, let's talk about the lawsuit that was brought before the court that came out in April, and to talk about that sojourn first.
Here's what we did. We filed a suit on behalf of our organization, Veterans for Common Sense, and another veterans organization, Veterans United for Truth. And the first thing we wanted at the top of our list was to force VA to stop turning away suicidal veterans. 2 days after we filed our lawsuit, VA announced that they would set up a toll-free suicide prevention hotline. And there's a silver lining in the lawsuit. More than 50,000 veterans or people have called that hotline, and the VA and their counselors who answer the phone, the number is 1-800-273-TALK. VA has said that they have performed more than 1,600 rescues where they sent out emergency responders to take care of the veteran. That's good news, that those veterans might have been saved. The bad news is that it took a lawsuit and massive publicity to force VA to do the right thing. Now, there's two things else going on with our lawsuit right now. The first is that the judge issued a decision in June 2008, and he said first that the veterans had standing to sue, which is very important. He let us in the door.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing he said is that the veterans had been harmed, and they were harmed by VA, and that the VA would continue to harm the veterans, that the system was broken. However, then the judge turned around and said that he lacked jurisdiction to order massive reforms at VA. So what we're doing now is we have filed notice that we are going to appeal, and we hope that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco, it's the federal courts, will hear our appeal and grant us what we want and order VA to first stop turning away the suicidal veterans and second, reform the broken claims process and the broken access to health care claims problem.
I want to open the phones here, and then I want to introduce all of you to some of the people that came out of this article. Some of them are the heroes of this article, like Dr. Francis Murphy, and some pretty incredible things went on as well, emails that were revealed. We'll come to that in a minute. 410-319-8888, and George, in your car, you're on the air.
My point is really kind of a simple one, but unfortunately, we've done this to our veterans after every war, from at least the Civil War. And I don't think most Americans know that it was so bad after the Civil War, similar to what we're hearing with this court case now, that the state of New York actually conducted a state investigation into the actions of the federal government for ignoring the needs of the veterans and for sending them home basically to die without giving them proper medical care because they wanted to discharge them rather than them die in service. And I think as a country, if we're ever going to end this, we as a nation, as a people, need to look at our past, look at what we've done to the veterans after, unfortunately, every war I think we've ever fought, and say to our politicians unequivocally, this is unacceptable. Never, ever allow this to happen again. And until we really rise up as a group and say it's unacceptable, I'm very much afraid that the heroes of our country are going to continue to be treated this way, and that should not be allowed in a civilized society. And I don't know why we as people put up with it century and decade after decade after decade. And we've got to put an end to it. People in Washington have to hear the voice. Never, ever again.
George, I thank you for that call, and that's one of the reasons we're doing these shows over and over again, so people do hear what's going on, that this does get exposed, and that people force our congressmen and senators to deal with this and address it, and just not let it happen. I think that there were ideas about how to reform this, and let's talk a bit about Dr. Francis Murphy for a moment, who testified, who was in the Veterans Administration, who came up with a plan, and what happened to that plan. I don't know who wants to grab the one first, Josh or Paul or all three of you.
Mark, you know, I think before getting to Dr. Murphy, his point's really important, but there's a missing step here. Not just that it's been happening for so many generations, but that the VA has been successfully handling it through a very complicated PR campaign. The statistic that comes to mind for me is the waiting period. They've been saying in the press and before Congress that it takes 6 months for a wounded veteran to get his benefits. Now, of course, there is that waiting period because the wounded vets have to come back and prove that they were wounded in war. I think even that is shocking. Many of the audience would think, my goodness, a wounded veteran in need of immediate care has to wait 6 months. Well, as was revealed at the federal courthouse in San Francisco, even those numbers are extraordinarily skewed. It turns out that the six-month waiting period is just the first step in the process. If a veteran decides to appeal his case, as 32,000 vets did last year, it takes an average of 3.5 years to resolve the appeal. That's in addition to that original 6 months. And, Mark, I was also interested to find out precisely what it means in VA terms for a case to be resolved. It turns out that if a veteran commits suicide, his case is considered resolved. So you can imagine a case in which a veteran comes back wounded from Iraq, seeks medical care and disability pay, doesn't receive it, and after waiting 4 agonizing months, decides to kill himself. You know, family and friends might look at that case and say the soldier died because he simply didn't receive care. But in PR terms, that actually helps the VA's image because a 4-month resolved case actually quickens their 6-month average.
And I want to get to this issue of suicides, and that's part of Dr. Ira Katz's emails, which are really important, which I was going to come out of with the ideas of what happened with Dr. Francis Murphy. And I wish you could pick up on that part, Paul, and then we'll go to our next caller.
Wow, you really brought up the smoking gun, Mark. Thanks for letting us talk about it. During our lawsuit of Veterans for Common Sense versus the Department of Veterans Affairs, we had discovery. That means we are allowed to look at VA's records to see if there's anything relevant to our lawsuit. We discovered emails by VA's top mental health expert, Ira Katz, to one of his PR officials, essentially that said, not, this is the title of the email, not for CBS News. So that was an intentional cover-up by a government employee of information. Then in the body of the email, it starts off by saying, shh, like S-H-H exclamation point. That's the level of trying to cover up the suicide epidemic. Let me give everyone the numbers that'll shock you. Right now, among Iraq and Afghanistan war veterans, I mentioned there's 350,000 that are patients at VA. 150,000 of those are mental health patients.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just 5 years for the Iraq War and 7 years for the Afghanistan wars. Those numbers are staggering, and we expect them to go higher. Veterans are committing suicide every day, and here's what VA had told CBS News. VA originally told CBS News that there were less than 800 suicide attempts per year among all veterans from all wars who are being treated at VA. And in one of the emails that we obtained under discovery in the lawsuit, VA admitted that there were actually 12,000 suicide attempts among veterans being treated. That's 15 times higher. And in another email, it gets worse. In another email, VA officials said that the CBS investigation and their methodology reporting about 6,500 suicides a year among all veterans was correct. However, just a few days before, under oath, in front of Congress, Ira Katz at the Department of Veterans Affairs said that the CBS methodology and numbers were wrong. Absolutely outrageous. Top VA officials intentionally covering up the suicide epidemic among veterans.
It's lying. I mean, this is. I'll read before as we go to the phones. I'll read you Dr. Katz's email, the one you were just referring to. Our suicide prevention coordinators are identifying about 1,000 suicide attempts per month among veterans we see in our medical facilities. Is this something we should carefully address ourselves in some sort of release before someone stumbles on it? And, I mean, there's a whole series of emails here where it's clear they're covering up what the facts are and the number. And then they say, well, it's not so bad if we're talking about 24 million veterans and only... And only 18 veterans kill themselves every day.
But that's right, Mark.
That to me was just one of the most outrageous things I read in the whole thing. 18 veterans a day kill themselves, but it's not a big deal because there are 24 million veterans. Who cares?
That's right.
Mark,
18 suicides a day, 120 a week, 602 suicides
in
the entire year.
Okay. Gentlemen, only one at a time. Let me let Paul finish, then Josh, and then go back to the phones here.
Oh, please.
Sorry, I can hardly hear anybody on the phone.
That's all right. That's okay.
This is why it's so important that veterans know that if they believe they're having problems, they should call, and they're suicidal or very concerned, they can call VA's suicide hotline, and they can also look in the phone book under the Department of Veterans Affairs. If the veteran believes he's having readjustment problems, he's having problems at work or with his family, he can look in the phone book under the Department of Veterans Affairs and look for something called Vet Center. Veteran can pick up the phone, call, and usually get an appointment right away. It's okay to seek help. And organizations like Veterans for Common Sense, we're fighting in Washington so that when that veteran shows up at the vet center or shows up at a VA hospital, the VA is ready to take care of them.
And Josh, well, then go ahead. Then I'm going to go back to the phones and we're going to bring Sergeant Jimenez back into this.
Sure. Well, not only did they write these emails to say that they had this extraordinary information about the massive number of suicides that they weren't revealing to the public. But Dr. Katz, the head of VA's mental health, actually stepped before Congress on two occasions to say they didn't have further information and then went back days later and wrote that email. They also went before Congress and said those CBS suicide figures that Paul just mentioned were absolutely false. Then he went back to his computer writing to a colleague and said they were absolutely true. You mentioned before Frances Murphy, and hers is a story definitely worth telling. She stepped before the public at a convention in D.C. in 2006 and acknowledged all of these problems. She had helped draft a plan which would basically revise the VA from top to bottom. They had over 200 points that they wanted to change. This plan was embraced by the VA, embraced by veterans communities as well. The problem was it was just never put into action. She knew that. She stepped before a prominent group of veterans' health and mental health officials in D.C. and acknowledged that fact, said that still, for the vast number of veterans out there, mental health care and other kinds of immediate needs simply aren't being met.
And
days later, she was fired, and into the public spotlight, they brought in this new official, Dr. Katz, the one who wrote those emails.
Joshua Kors wrote the article, How the VA Abandons Our Vets. Paul Sullivan helped launch the lawsuit. Paul Sullivan is executive director for Veterans for Common Sense. Sergeant Juan Jimenez is a man who fought in Iraq, was severely injured by IEDs, hit twice by IEDs, and is still fighting to get his benefits for post-traumatic stress disorder. 410-319-8888 is the number here, or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. I know I'm not the only human being here in America who's outraged by this. And George in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, I was calling because I wanted you guys to maybe touch base on the possible problem that I think there were some budget cuts in the veterans benefits a year or so ago. And also, I think that when we look at what happened in Iraq, initially it was everything, the war was far from the air and everything was gloomy and hunky-dory. But once they got on the ground, they didn't have a plan there. So subsequently, we received the veterans in these conditions here now, and I was wanting someone to comment on that because these are parallels that should be discussed as well.
That's interesting points. Paul, Josh, Juan, anybody want to pick that up?
Well, I can jump in on the budget issue.
Paul.
I'm pleased to report that Congress has added several more $1 billion to VA's budget this year, and the president just quickly signed it a few days ago. But here's what everybody needs to know. There's billions and billions of more dollars going into VA. However, the flood, the tidal wave of hundreds of thousands of new patients from the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, plus the Vietnam veterans coming in with Agent Orange disabilities, plus the Vietnam and Gulf War and other veterans coming in with their unresolved post-traumatic stress disorder and mental health issues coming in, that means that the amount of money is not keeping pace with the demand, and the amount of money being spent per veteran by VA is going down. Now, what does all this mean? A Harvard University professor, Linda Bilmes, and Columbia University professor, Joseph Stiglitz, who earned the Nobel Prize in Economics,
right,
wrote a book, The $3 Trillion War. And Veterans for Common Sense helped with two chapters in that book to deal with the Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, while the whole world is running chicken little scared about $700 billion in bailout money needed for Wall Street, that's the same number these economists estimate, $700 billion, that will be needed to take care of the 1.7 million service members sent over to the Iraq and Afghanistan war. And that's because our service members are surviving much more horrific bomb blasts, and they're serving longer with multiple deployments, which means they're at higher risk for mental health problems.
I'm going to talk about some of these numbers in a moment, but let me go back to the phones first at 410-319-8888. Robert, you're on the air.
Yeah, I've been listening to it, and I'm very troubled. My sons have taken a different path, but where is the Defense Department in terms of supplying support for these young men, and why would any parent want to give them their son understanding this information? I mean, there are too many young men that see this as a viable means of making a living to be take this gamble.
That's an interesting question. Juan, I want to take that up. And actually, it's young men and women these days. There are many women in combat as well as men, and many women being equally as hurt as men by IEDs and these wars that we're facing. It's a different armed services than we all remember 40 years ago. Juan, do you want to jump in here with some of that? Your thought about that?
Well, my stepdaughter, she just joined the military. She's actually in a reserve unit. I actually tried to talk her out of it, but, you know, she decided to go. I'm not sure if her unit is going to be deployed, but like most reservists, a lot of them, they won't file disability claims because, like my stepdaughter, she has a very good job in the civilian sector, and I have a lot of friends that are police officers,
mm-hmm.
and they would not file claims because then it would hurt their civilian jobs. So that's another thing that's going to hurt the VA. Once these guys get diagnosed with these PTSD issues where they might lose their jobs, then, you know, that's going to be a big issue. As far as letting your kids join, right now, it's like a toss coin, you know. I would allow them to join, you know, just because I feel that, you know, as an American, we should all join.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, the outcome of it. You know, are you going to go get hurt, or even if you don't get hurt, you experience the PTSD, and is a doctor in active duty going to say, well, he has a mental disorder, then you come home and you cannot put in a claim because now you have a mental disorder. You don't have PTSD. And, you know, I found out that that's what a lot of the active duty doctors are doing now. They're actually, you know, giving them these disorders, so then they can't put in a claim.
That's so insane. It just makes you angry. At least makes me angry. And I wonder, let me just ask before I turn back to Paul and Joshua, Juan, if you would, I'm just curious about how you're doing. I mean, how is your day-to-day life, and how are you coping with all this, and how are you doing?
Well, in the beginning, I wasn't doing so well. I basically returned home to my wife and children, and I was having problem sleeping, problem with the seizures, and I end up moving away because of my PTSD issues, and my wife was always saying that she want her husband back. She don't know, you know, who I was. And a lot of my friends are going through similar things. You know, their wives are saying the same thing. And what the American people don't realize is that since 2001, we are getting deployed. So it's deployment after deployment after deployment. You're never going to come home the same if you're never home. Out of 6 years, you're maybe home 1 year. You know, you're not going to come home the same. And I feel that's the problem. That's why we're coming home with all these mental disorders or, you know, PTSD issues, is because we're so angry that, you know, we're seeing and experiencing things that, you know, you normally don't experience at home.
Paul, I wish you would come back in. Paul Sullivan, who's the Executive Director of Veterans for Common Sense, for me to turn back to Joshua Kors. And we heard Juan's his personal story and a bit about him at this moment, but talk about the numbers we're talking about here. The amount of men and women we're talking about who are coming home with traumatic brain injury, PTSD, and there's a pretty staggering number of people that America has to care for here.
Well, let me try to sum this up without dizzying anybody with numbers.
All right.
Right now, the United States has sent to the Iraq and Afghanistan wars a total of 1.7 million soldiers. Now, about a third of those, about 600,000, have gone to the war zone twice or more. Now, out of that 1.7 million, there are about 900,000 veterans. They're out of the military and eligible to go on and use the Department of Veterans Affairs, the hospitals, and whatnot. Out of that 900,000, VA is providing medical care to 350,000. That is off the charts. And I'm really tired when I pick up the newspaper, you know, the Washington Post or the New York Times, or watch TV, and everyone talks about the 4,000 to 5,000 dead from the two wars. That's terrible. That's tragic. We need to remember their service and honor it. We also need to make sure that everybody knows there's 350,000 survivors who are the walking, wounded, injured, and ill from the war, and we're going to have to take care of them for a long time, 30, 40, 50 years, a lifetime of medical care and disability benefits. And, you know, if I may, Mark, here's why I think America doesn't know this. During World War II, about 10% of the entire U.S. population, about 12 million soldiers, went overseas to fight the Nazis in Germany and the Japanese in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That meant that, because most of all those were men, that about one in five houses on the street had someone off in the war. Right now, out of a population of more than 300 million, and we've sent just over 1.5 million to the wars, about one in every 200 houses might have someone who went to the war. And this percentage, this small percentage of the population, has an enormous burden to carry the war. And we want to make sure, and I like that caller who said never again, we at Veterans for Common Sense, we filed suit now because we had the documentation to show that there was a flood of claims and a flood of patients, and we had the documentation that showed that VA was dragging their feet. And we wanted to fight this now.
Paul, I'm only choosing because we have very little time left, and maybe it's time for us to think. Maybe we need a bailout for our veterans instead of Wall Street. But
Mark,
Joshua Kors, a quick thought. We have about could you give something in a minute or less here before we go back to the phones?
Absolutely. A bailout for these veterans. Washington is not deaf to these issues. And in fact, in the last few days, there's been a flurry of activity on Capitol Hill with a new bill, the Veterans Disability Benefits Claims Modernization Act, which would do something very unique. It would eliminate the proof system that we talked about for unequivocally war-related injuries. One would think that through that, Sergeant Jimenez would be able to get his benefits right away, had he been fighting a year from now. President Bush has already indicated...
Josh, I'm sorry to interrupt, but we're almost out of time here, and I want to point people to joshuacourse.com to read this story. We'll come back to all of this. And Joshua Kors, thank you so much for all the work you've done. Paul Sullivan, thank you for fighting for our veterans. And Sergeant Juan Jimenez, thank you for fighting for our country.
Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Mark.
WA is looking for area restaurants, by the way, and caterers provide in-kind food donation in the upcoming fall membership drive. And if you do that, it's a unique opportunity to help WEAA, and we'll acknowledge your restaurant on the air. So call 443-885-2075 and feed the hungry troops here at WEAA. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're directly engineered by Zach Coleman. Our intern is Judith Lloyd. Theme music by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. You can listen to this show and all of our past shows at our website, steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.